Good morning, everyone, and welcome to The Warehouse. My name is Emily Winicky, and I am the Community Engagement Coordinator here at Syracuse University. I would like to begin, as we do with all Syracuse University events, by acknowledging with respect the Onondaga Nation, the indigenous people on whose ancestral lands Syracuse University now stands. This morning's program is the second collaborative session with Focus Greater Syracuse. I would like to welcome our guests from Focus, and I hope you join us for future TMRs. And then also for our TMR folks, please check out our Focus forums in the future. I am now honored to introduce the Executive Director of Focus, Greater Syracuse, Jim Kibe.
Well, thank you, Emily, for that introduction, and thanks to B. Gonzalez for encouraging and supporting the partnership between Focus and TMR. From the turnout we have this morning, I think we're receiving very positive response to the idea of Focus and TMR co-promoting community discussions. As they say, I think we're going to need a bigger boat. Let me also take a minute to thank our overall sponsor of this forum series, the Onondaga Civic Development Corp. It is only because of the support of the County Economic Development Team and the OCDC board that we are able to put on this informational series. So for those of you who attended the first Economic Development Forum a few weeks ago, and to those who came this morning to hear about economic development for the first time, welcome and thank you for coming. This second in a series of community forums has been designed to inform and educate Onondaga County and City of Syracuse citizens on how economic development priorities and projects work here in Central New York. With the goal in mind, we have assembled this group of economic development professionals who will first provide you with some background on how the mechanics of economic development work in Onondaga County, and who then will take your individual questions. I will also need to leave time at the end of the session for one or two questions that are important for Focus to ask as we move forward with the series, so expect me to do that. I'm going to put up the Focus mission. I'm not going to read that because we really have great speakers here tonight, and we do have a one-hour time limit as we do this program, so I'm just going to put some of this stuff up, and you can read it on your own. And then I'll put this up. This gives you an idea of our speakers so you have their names. So you have the bios in front of you, the complete bios of our panelists on the back of your agenda. So I'll do a quick introduction of each of them, and then they're going to take 5 minutes with their opening remarks. First, I want to introduce Andrew Fish. Andrew is Senior Vice President for Business Development at Center State CEO. He plays a central role in administering and coordinating Center State's economic development, member services, business attraction and retention, and global competitiveness. Today, I have specifically asked Andrew to talk about the Regional Economic Development Council, also known as the REDC, and how it fits in overall regional economic development planning. Second, let me introduce Nora Spillane. Nora is Deputy Commissioner of Neighborhood and Business Development for the City of Syracuse and Executive Director of the Syracuse Industrial Development Agency, SIDA. Nora also served on the County IDA Board, and I have asked her to explain the IDAs and how they are structured and function in New York State. Joe Russo is an Economic Development Program Manager for National Grid. He has worked in economic development and community development in New York State since 1978 with experience as a city, county, chamber of commerce, and utility economic development manager. I consider Joe to be one of our local economic development historians, and I have asked Joe to fill you in on the programs that National Grid offers in terms of economic development support, something that is unique in New York State and maybe something most of you are not aware of. Our fourth speaker is Laura Miller. Laura is not here as of yet. I expect her any minute. Laura is the general manager of Darko Manufacturing and has worked for the provider of CNC machining services for over 25 years. She is responsible for managing business and equipment, the Darko team, to meet market demand. Laura is our private sector special panelist, and I have asked Laura to share some of her observations on how, when, and if economic development programs have impacted and supported her local manufacturing business. I think she's also going to say a few words about Making It Happen in Central New York, which is an organization she leads. So with all that being said, let me ask Andrew Fish to speak first. Andrew?
As Jim was going down and reading all the introductions, I was struck by the fact that probably of the topics that we have to discuss, Joe could probably very adequately present on Nora's, and Nora's could present on mine, and I could present on Nora's or Joe's, and vice versa, because we all work really closely together and have a lot of opportunity to get to know each other, the programs, the opportunities that exist, and how we can come together to support business. But specifically, I'm going to talk to you about the Regional Economic Development Councils, the REDCs. And one of the things I'll ask is that if I start using acronyms, I'm going to ask my panelists to elbow me, but if you need to throw things or wave and get my attention and help me realize that I've just had a complete sentence and nothing but acronyms so that we can go back and go over what those are. But the REDC, Regional Economic Development Councils, were formed in 2011, and it was a new way for New York State to do economic development. Previous to that, if you had an economic development project, you would come to your regional Empire State Development office, you would fill out some forms. Those forms would be submitted to a review committee. That review committee sat somewhere in the southeast corner of New York State, to be unnamed, and that project would be reviewed amongst the dozens of others across New York State, and not really with any context for what it meant for that local community or what it meant for the strategy that that particular region or that particular city or that particular town was trying to accomplish. And so oftentimes we had challenges in upstate getting our projects, which may have been smaller or may have been not as many jobs, being viewed as favorably as some of the larger downstate projects. But in 2011, that changed. The Regional Economic Development Councils were formed. There's 10 regions in New York State. We sit in the Central New York region. It's the five counties of Central New York: Onondaga County, Cayuga, Oswego, Madison, and Cortland. So it's Syracuse and the surrounding county and counties. That council in 2011 was charged with putting together a strategic plan for the region. So a strategic plan that focused on what are the region's strengths, what are the opportunities, and how are we going to advance this region. In addition to that, we were asked to prioritize projects that aligned with the strategic objectives of that plan. In Central New York, we came up with three overarching goals. It was a recognition that we have a very diverse economy in terms of industry diversification. We have no one industry that has more than 13% of the job concentration in Central New York. And so it's a very diverse diverse region in that regard. And so we wanted to target those, we wanted to strengthen those targeted industry clusters. The second goal was we wanted to increase our global competitiveness. So this was increase exporting, increasing our infrastructure that allowed us to get goods out of Central New York and into other markets. And also we wanted to increase our human capital. So the people that are here, how do we make them the best possible for the businesses to be able to compete? And then the third goal was revitalizing our main streets and urban cores. And so this wasn't just our downtown Syracuse, this was our neighborhoods and villages throughout the Central New York region, and how did we create great places for people to live and to take ownership in, and how do we revitalize some of the aging building infrastructure that we had and create vibrant downtowns. Those three goals have served us well as a roadmap over the eight rounds now. We're just submitted the eighth round for the Regional Economic Development Council. And Central New York has actually been the most successful region in all of New York State as it relates to bringing dollars to this region. We've had more state dollars invested through the different agencies for economic development projects in Central New York than any of the other nine regions in New York State. So there's a pretty intensive community engagement process that has gone on, very much so in the first couple of years, and then also when the upstate revitalization occurred in 2015. So the URI was a kind of add-on competition to the Regional Economic Development Council, and it was a $500 million competition. Well, $1.5 billion total, three regions in New York State, the seven regions of upstate minus Western New York. And so those seven regions were competing for three prizes of $500 million each, and we were successful in Central New York in securing that. The council is comprised of about 22 different individuals throughout the region. heavy business representation. You also have education and healthcare institutions that are prevalent there. There's two co-chairs. Currently, the co-chairs of the council are Randy Wolkin with the Manufacturers Association of Central New York and Daniela Roccarina from Upstate Medical University. Previous to that, Rob Simpson was the co-chair along with Daniela Roccarina, and then prior to that, it was Kent Severud and then Nancy Cantor prior to that as well. So there's been a few changes there, and we at Center State CEO have been heavily involved in this process from the beginning, and mostly providing some technical support, some writing support for the progress report, especially when Rob was the co-chair. But it's a really great process to be a part of and see the region really coming together and collaborating and driving towards a shared vision of what we want to accomplish in Central New York. And there's been many jobs created, millions of dollars of capital investment, actually I think billions of dollars of capital investment to this point. And you know, we continue to see a strong set of projects that we just submitted for round eight. The application process usually opens in May, closes in July. Then we score the projects, come up with a priority project list, update the progress report. We submit that to New York State in October, beginning of October, and we will find out in the beginning of December how we fared this round and whether we were a top plan. Each year, how much you're competing for has changed. This year, if we're a top plan, we'll receive $20 million of capital grant money from New York State to fund these projects. If we're not a successful, if we're not a winning plan, we'll still receive $10 million in capital grant money to fund those projects. The first round, the competition was much more high stakes. If you won, it was $40 million in capital, and if you lost. It was $6.5 million in capital that you received, so a large disparity, and those numbers have kind of closed over the years. One of the things I will say is that, you know, these projects, the state resources that go into this, they're all but for dollars, meaning but for that money, the project wouldn't move forward. And so it's a challenging thing for companies to submit for these projects in July and wait till December to find out and start, because market opportunities sometimes move faster than that. And the other thing I will say is that all of these dollars from New York State are reimbursable. So when you see these announcements, this company is receiving X millions of dollars to build this facility and create these jobs, they don't get that money unless they've actually built that facility or created those jobs through the Regional Economic Development Council process. So that's one of the things that I know sometimes people ask that question: what happens when a company doesn't move forward with the project? You know, those monies never flowed to that company, so it's not like those dollars are gone and the state, you know, doesn't have the ability to reallocate those to other projects. So there's a lot more I could talk about, but I think I'm well past my 5 minutes, and I know we've got a lot more to talk about with the IDAs and National Grid, but happy to answer any questions later as they come up.
Thank you, Andrew. Nora?
Good morning. I'd like to thank Focus for having us all here. I think this is a really interesting topic and one that probably has changed over the years, so it's good to sort of remind everybody. I'm Nora Spillane. I'm the Deputy Commissioner in the Department of Neighborhood and Business Development with the City of Syracuse, and probably have the dubious distinction of having worked for both IDAs in the county. So I was staffed to the county's IDA for a few years, and then been with the city now about 2.5 years, and have been working with the city's IDA side up. So what is an IDA? An IDA is an industrial development agency, which is a sort of misnomer from the late 60s that now is codified in state law, so we're stuck with it. let's be honest. So IDAs, there are, you know, 62 counties in the state, probably over 100 IDAs across the state. Towns can create IDAs, counties can create IDAs, a municipality has the ability to do it. And an IDA is really there to, I think, and Fish, if you have any thoughts, buffer between a municipality and those politically charged decisions around economic development incentives. IDAs can do four primary things, no matter what IDA you are. They can issue bonds for small manufacturing projects and certain types of projects, and there are some financing pros and cons around that. They do sales tax abatements, so on the goods and services you use to get a project up and running, they abate the 4% local and 4% state sales tax. There's a mortgage recording tax abatement. In communities where there's a transportation authority, like here, they abate, there's a 1% mortgage recording tax, we abate 3/4 of that. It used to just be 1%, but 1/4 of that now, is not abated and stays going to the transportation authorities. The last one is probably the most sensitive, is the property tax abatement, or pilots. Property tax pilots are a payment in lieu of tax agreement that are a thing. Those are all, they all sound really great and whatever, but they are, as Andrew said, another thing that doesn't happen unless a project does something. Both the IDAs I've worked for have strict monitoring, strict rules, strict evaluation of projects. We're required by the state to do a cost-benefit analysis of the project and the benefits to the community versus what's being abated, and come up with a number. Often those numbers are 10 to 1, 23 to 1, 100 to 1. So for every $1 abatement, you're getting some additional return back into the community. So I think, you know, as you think about these numbers and you think about some of the numbers Andrew talked about for, you know, those public investments, we're really leveraging quite a lot of private sector dollars. And I think people talk especially about IDAs, well, what does that mean for local governments? And I think that's where, as a nerd, the cost benefit is really helpful. You can point to the new wages, the new benefits, the construction jobs, the ancillary benefits and the multiplying effects of businesses expanding and growing as compared to the 8% sales tax, for example. So there's some nuance to IDAs. Obviously, IDAs have different priorities, and each IDA has the ability to sort of set those priorities through their policies and procedures. IDAs are also fairly transparent, much as people maybe not think. We're subject to open meetings law, so we have to notice our meetings. They are public. Anybody can come. We have public hearings before we vote on any benefits. We're required to put a lot of information on our websites about the staff, about the board, about our finances, about the projects, the cost-benefit analyses. We are audited every year by an independent auditor, and those audits are published. The state publishes all of our information as well. So if you want to know anything about an IDA, it's a quick Google search away, really. And I would say, lastly, IDAs are a tool. They're really a tool in the toolbox of economic development. IDAs don't drive economic development. They're really a part of a larger strategy. And how we use those strategically to advance a community's goals is really critical. They're an important tool, but they're not the tool. And I would think, you know, with the regional economic development councils and the other partners we have, and National Grid is a fantastic partner, we really pull a suite of sources together to really make things happen. But I'd be happy to answer any questions after, but I think that's the overview.
Thank you, Nora. Joe, you have a few slides. I'll get this going for you here and get this to you. There you are. Hey. There's Joe. Oh. You notice the resemblance between Joe? There you go.
That's my current badge, too, to get into the building. I just celebrated a couple days ago my 23rd year anniversary at National Grid. Niagara Mohawk is where I started, 1995. So it's also my 36th year wedding anniversary. So double celebration. But that's what they gave me on the first day of work to get into the building. I'm still using it. And people that see me with it say, that aren't in the building, say, "Is that you?" And I have to say, yeah, that was me when I was a young person, relatively young. But being there 23 years, I've seen a lot of changes. You know, the biggest of which was National Grid purchasing Niagara Mohawk. And it was a purchase, so it wasn't a merger. And but out of that came a lot of good things. And Niagara Mohawk was a great company, but it was going bankrupt, and it needed new ownership and new leadership, and we've gone through a lot of changes, but it's been pretty good ride, and I'll explain it. Why do we do it? Okay, a lot of people, how many in the room knew that National Grid was involved in economic development? Of course, Dave Michael and Don Western do. We worked with them for many years, but, well, that's good. I'm glad you do, because a lot of people don't realize that utilities are involved. We kind of fade into the background. We're not out there at the press conferences cutting ribbons and taking credit like elected officials and others do, because that's the lifeblood of politics, isn't it? I mean, they want to be involved because they want to see that tax base. They want to see the tax base grow. They want to see jobs. So they're really... out there leading the effort, and then people like us kind of work to support them, the elected officials, the legislatures, the town officials. They all want tax base, let's face it. That's what makes government run. And people focus on the jobs, but the elected officials, believe me, they want tax base. They want to see buildings built, and they want to see buildings renovated. So health of the communities is what we're in it for. We used to be in it for the money back in the day when we owned power plants, back in the day of vertically regulated utilities. Utilities got into railroads were the first to get into economic development back in the 1800s. And then the utilities followed because it was in our business interest to do so. It would expand our footprint. It would expand our revenue base. That's not the case anymore. We're deregulated. We don't have power plants anymore. We have we deliver power under regulated tariffs. And we actually are incentivized to encourage our customers to use less power. Okay, so we're not in it for the money. We're in it for retaining our customer base, helping our communities, and getting people to use energy more efficiently at the same time. We have a long tradition. We traced it back to 1939 and found a newsletter from the 1960s that said, Niagara Mohawk welcomes Hooker Chemical to Love Canal. So we were involved in that, unfortunately. So we try to be good corporate citizens. So we work as a team. We have an internal team at National Grid. You know, a lot of good professionals that have been there a while that have learned this business from the inside and from the outside. We learn from our partners and we work with our partners, the people you see here. We support our partners. We promote our assets. Our assets being here in Central New York, tons of power. You know, a big hub out in the town of Clay for power that comes down from Lake Ontario from the power plants up there. There's a site in the town of Clay right next to that substation that is owned by the county IDA. It's called White Pines now.
It is. Yeah.
And it was developed over the years. Don Western was the key person that got involved in that and got it done, actually, over the years. It took a lot of time and effort. And that site now is probably one of the premier sites in the state for high-tech manufacturing. It's got a lot of water. It's got a 45-inch water line there coming down from Lake Ontario. It's got heavy power at the 115 level, 115 kV level. That's stepped down from 320,000 volts into the substation. So that is a very unique site. So that's a major asset here in this area that a lot of people may not know about. But the county IDA's had it for a while, and it's been in competitions for bulk pharmaceutical manufacturing and other competitions. Hasn't won one yet, but will do so eventually because it's not, you know, some of the things that we talk about that inhibit business in New York State is our costs. Our costs are higher than other states, and they are. We can't deny that. But when you're talking about costs not being the major factor in a company locating, then when you're talking about semiconductor manufacturing, of which we have in Saratoga County that located there, it wasn't for the low costs, it was for the high performance capabilities, the workforce, the power, the utilities. Believe it or not, our electric rates, though they may seem high to us, are pretty competitive, especially now that the commodity cost has come down in the region because of shale gas production. So we're very competitive on power, we're very competitive on water. Our workforce is outstanding. We have an outstanding workforce in upstate New York in our regions that is highly educated. I was at International Paper's plant in Ticonderoga yesterday. Anybody ever been there? Yeah, it's phenomenal. They make this. They make, like, Hammer Mill is their brand. They make this. And you would think, well, how can you make paper in New York State? It costs so much. And a lot of our plants have closed. Champion International up in Jefferson County, Newton Falls Fine Paper up in the town of Fine. Many, many, many of them closed. Of course, we've seen paper recycling out in Salve, though, the newer style. But this, they bring logs into Ticonderoga, into the plant, and they make pulp, and they turn it into paper with huge paper machines. They've got 650 people working there, 620 people working there, and they get them right out of high school. And they bring them in and train them how to run a paper plant. And so you can do it in New York. And they said that they've never had a better few years than they've had in the history of the plant. So you can even make a commodity in New York, like paper, and do well. So it's not all about the cost. We talk a lot here about the transactions, the incentives, closing deals, and everything. But it's real. As Nora was saying, it's the end game. It's the end part of the process of either helping a company expand or helping to locate a new company. And I think we heard that a couple weeks ago from our speakers that were here, Chris Steele, the site selection person, and Jim Demikas. So National Grid, you know, we're involved in every facet of it in the background mostly, but you know, we do have funding. And that's what was created by the merger settlement agreement with National Grid. But before that, we could do discounts. We even couldn't even do energy efficiency back in the day. We'd get yanked into meetings. Oh, this company's going to leave the state if they don't lower their costs. And we'd sit there, and we couldn't even say, well, we've got these energy efficiency programs that can help you use less. But now we do have those tools. We also have grant programs that were created by the Public Service Commission, giving permission to do so. We've invested $75 million in these programs since 2003, since the settlement agreement. They go into infrastructure. We remove barriers to economic development with grants for infrastructure. We provide grants for marketing to groups like CEO to market their region. We provide grants for community development, like to the Hotel Syracuse project for cleaning up the asbestos in there. We design the programs in conjunction with our partners, so we design them so that they could be easily, our partners could easily work with them. So we're more of a support group than we are an economic development leading group out front. These people are out front. We're behind them all the way. That's it.
Yep. Thanks, Joe. Laura's up next, and we have, I think, a little PowerPoint for you, right, Laura?
I believe we do, but even if we don't, we're fine.
All right. Well, we'll get that loaded up if you want to start.
Great. So my name is Laura Miller, and I'm general manager of Darko Manufacturing, and I brought a bag of tricks. These are some of the things we make. I'll lay them out on the table.
Yes. Do we have to guess what that does? Is that kind of part of the...
Let's do that. Does anybody want to guess what this is for?
Kind of looks like a bottle of wine. It's something that my wife would buy.
It's the heart of a hydraulic system.
Oh.
And this is a precision valve that goes into a hydraulic system. Now, this kind of assembly goes all over the world in all kinds of hydraulic assemblies, farm implements, anything that lifts or moves something heavy.
Huh.
And that's plastic.
Nope, this is aluminum, and this
aluminum.
Is steel.
Wow. It looks like.
And we can play with these later. But the reason I brought these goods is because the niche that we're in is intermediate goods. We produce intermediate goods, which, as it turns out, and we have economic developers here, so this is great, intermediate goods is a huge percentage of our GDP. Can we guess what that would be?
The region.
60% of our goods production.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. In terms of GDP, probably 20-25% of our GDP is right here. Does anybody want to guess what that means in numbers? I'm going to play a little bit here. Probably $7 billion a year, just this niche. So I have kind of run alongside our economic developers, and I'd like to mention that going to IDA meetings is a great way to understand what's going on in the region, especially if you're in sales. I recommend going and attending. It's a good way to learn. And also National Grid has been very helpful in reducing energy efficiency. If you need a new compressor in your plant and it's more efficient, they help you out. So. So I'm also co-founder of a little ragtag initiative that takes place out in the wild in the private sector called Making It in Central New York. And I co-founded this with Cookie Kaloya, who has a lifetime.
Oh my God, my family knows the Kaloyas very well.
So the Kaloyas made their living fixing things and selling things right here in the region. And we arranged ourselves around the very question that we're here today to explore, which is, where's the narrative coming from? Where's some of the negativity? And I think you, Jim, wrote about sort of self-inflicted obstacles.
Yeah, we'll talk about that later, sure.
Yeah, so we arranged ourselves around that question, and we just decided we would talk about the strength of manufacturing, the creativity, the workforce, all the things that we do really well here that we don't tend to dwell on. So we send parts and objects, whether they're finished or intermediate, all over the world, and I think that goes uncelebrated. So what MCNE does, and it's all volunteer, and we would welcome any volunteer help if anybody would like to help us. What we do, we kind of divide ourselves up into three branches. We market what we actually do and which companies are hiring and what kinds of activities are going on out in the wild. We spend a lot of time connecting human beings to business, whether they're students or whether they're people maybe seeking a career change. Anybody who wants to kind of get into the world of producing goods, we try to help them find a way to do that. And then a really important piece is we try to connect businesses to one another. Because what happened in the last 30 years is we lost some of those neural pathways where we were connected. And so we're trying to reconnect some of that supply chain activity, some of the strength of the relationships that we had before we got merged and acquired and before our recession. And we have all these pieces of a supply chain and a value chain, and sometimes they need to be reconnected. So we spend our time, most of our time, connecting people to our lines of work.
Excellent. Let me start off the questions, then I'll walk around the room here as you brought up an interesting point. In our previous, in our first session, a question did come up to our site selector in particular about this issue of negativism, if you want to call it, whether it comes through in media one way or another, social media. If each one of you could real quickly talk about that, and how does that impact the job that you do? How does it impact the IDA's work? How does it impact the Regional Economic Development Council? How do each of you try to counteract those things? And is it a real thing, and when does it come up? Andrew, why don't you start, and we'll go down.
I have a lot to say on this subject, Jim, as you know, but I'll focus in a little bit and keep it brief. So it is really one of our biggest liabilities is our own perception of ourselves in this region. I love having these conversations at forums like this, because those of you that are showing up here and those of you that are coming out are not generally the ones that are the challenge or the problem, because you're actively seeking out the truth of the information. It's so much easier to just hear something that's negative and repeat it as truth. The reality of it is that we have a lot of challenges in this community. Every community does. But we also have a ton of strengths, and we have a ton of positive things that are happening. I cannot remember a time I've been in economic development slightly less than Joe, but you know, for more than a decade, and I have never seen as much activity as I'm seeing right now. And that's a product of, yes, the global economy and how things are moving, but it's also a product of the momentum that we're generating here in Central New York and the you know, the activity that's happening, and you know, growth begets growth, and positive things are really on the rise right now. And if all we do is sit back and say, oh, well, you know, remember when it was this, or it's never going to be that, It's too bad that we lost that one company. I was talking with somebody and you know, they're still talking about stuff that happened 12, 13, 14, 15 years ago. And the global economy changes annually, you know, and we're still stuck in what happened sometimes even longer ago than that. But, you know, and we're missing out on the bright spots of the things that are happening today and the positive things that are happening. And it doesn't mean that it's all good news, and it doesn't mean that it's all daisies and roses. We have to face those challenges in a realistic way. But we also have to recognize that there are good things happening. And we are on the verge of moving into the next generation economy. And we're actually positioning ourselves well in central New York. And for the first time, we're actually in a position to potentially catch the front curve of a massive market as it relates to some of the tech stuff that's happening with the unmanned systems, as it relates to some of the tech stuff that's happening with some of the digital learning and automation. And that's coming from what we have always been. We've always been a strong technical community. I mean, the sensing technologies and the engineering talent that is in this region is second to none, and it's why we oftentimes have such a plethora of opportunities that present themselves. But as you said, when companies are looking, we don't even get the phone call until they've done, you know, hundreds of hours of research on where they want to go. And some of that research is looking at what's being publicized in our local circulations, looking at what the comments are sometimes on those online publications, and trying to understand what's the community perception as it relates to economic development and jobs, and is it positive or is it negative? And that is one of our biggest liabilities.
Ditto. I think Andrew said it quite well. I think on a more granular local level, what gets lost in the shuffle sometimes are the good things that come out of these projects or these approaches, specifically around IDAs. What do we do aside from, you know, quote unquote, just throwing away taxpayer dollars, which we don't. But, you know, what do we do as a positive influence on the community? You know, the state as of late has really restricted how IDAs can use their fee income. We get a fee for projects. So we've been thinking creatively about ways that we can be a resource for the city. And I know the county has done similar work with, you know, their acquisition of Roth Steel and how they can be a positive force on some of these things. We've, at the city IDA, looked to you know, ways we can support city initiatives, things like the Bureau of Administrative Adjudication. It sounds dry and boring, but that's going to really radically change code enforcement, which is going to radically change how our city looks and how we deal with blight, and that's going to raise our standard of living. So that little, you know, tweak in our budget every year is going to have a dramatic impact, and that's behind the scenes, and it's not a great story, and it's really dry. But, you know, it's something that's really happening that we're able to support and we're proud to support. So I think Andrew's absolutely right that a lot of what we miss out on, we'll never know. The digital economy has changed how people go through site selection, I would say. I mean, Joe, you probably have a great perspective on this. Used to get calls and talk and be able to market, and now if you're not proactive and out there just with good content, you're missing out. You've just already missed the boat. And that's a critical piece that we underestimate. And I think when we are down on ourselves as a community, when we focus on the negative things that are happening, people notice that. And, you know, I think we've all had the experience of people saying, you know, Syracuse seems to have a lot of really good stuff going on. Why are you guys constantly in the negative? And I go, I don't know. You know, it's a great place to live. It's a great place to grow. It's a great place to have a family. And that's why we're all here. If you don't like it, you know.
Well, don't say that.
Joe? You know,
but in all seriousness, it's important. It's important to find the value in why we're here and to tell people and to celebrate it.
True.
That's not you.
And people do leave, but young people especially, but they come back when they want to have families. You know, young people in their 20s, early, I got a millennial down in New York City that had to be down there with his friends, you know, and they live in a 6th floor walk up on the east side, and they're all poor, you know, but that's where they want to be, you know. But eventually, when they want to start a family or whatever, the likelihood is they're going to come home. I have my other two sons are here. But so it's how many people we get to come back, I think, that is the key to everything. Because young people, they want to move. And, you know, nowadays young people, They want to go. They don't even have a job when they go somewhere to live. They say, I want to live here, and then they go there, and then they get a job. And it's amazing. So we're in a tough competition for those people. You know, we need to retain the ones we have, and we need to try to bring some of them back. Because it's the key is having a workforce that can support businesses. And if we keep losing workforce, we're in trouble. And I think that's what people feel. That's where the negativity may come from, that people may feel that we're losing talent, we're losing workforce, we're not just plants and shutting down and such, but it's not really true. We've had some real tough times during recessions, but have bounced back pretty good. The negativity, I think, is born out of years and years of just one loss after another. But I don't see negativity hindering our business community. I don't see it hindering our ability to compete for businesses. It's more a numbers game. Competing for a site selection is more of a numbers game than, we don't like these people's attitudes. It would be good if we had a more positive, if we had more positivity, but we have plenty of it, and it's probably enough for us to continue to grow. And Andrew's correct, we're going through a tremendous period right now of growth, and so we need to take advantage of that. And I think that, the next recession may be around the corner. We weathered the last one pretty good. Okay, the one in the early 90s, the George H.W. Bush recession, that was bad. We lost population. But we've bounced back pretty good, so there's really not a need to be negative.
Again, I think I'll ask the audience, in terms of manufacturing, what are your perceptions on the ground here? Is your perception that we're losing work, losing jobs, losing revenue, or what do you hear from the media?
Oh, nobody's going to say that now, not after
right.
the four.
Yeah. Right. So most of you are hearing that we're growing.
You can look at the county budget, and they have a thing, and so unemployment and unemployment are now, but the number of employed people in the community have also gone down for the last year. So that, how do you, if you don't have more people and more people working, what does that mean in the long term? What are the demographics? How do the demographics involve us, right? How are they assuming more people aging out of the workforce and staying? Like, there could be rah-rah, let's go, but like, there are real challenges.
Yeah, well, let me get
there are real challenges on the manufacturing side, but we do not have the constraints that we think we do. And relative to other regions, we're stronger. We have more available labor, and our labor, the labor that's in the workforce now is seasoned and has gray hair and is busily seasoning up the next generation. That's going on right now in the wild. And it's a beautiful thing to watch because kids are really interested in pairing up with older people and learning.
Let me get some questions now. Hang on.
Just one more comment on the negativity real quick and also a little bit to Tim's point. Joe said something great. Workforce is the number one challenge right now, all right? And when I talked about that negative liability, it's more the people who are thinking about coming back to this region and looking to get the jobs here that are concerned about that attitude. I mean, if someone gave me an anecdotal story yesterday that they're from here and they're flying back on the plane and they're with somebody that's from here and they're like, why do you live in Syracuse? I'm getting out of there as soon as I can. And it's that mentality. There are thousands of jobs open right now in Central New York. That declining workforce is a problem. The workforce labor participation rate, that's a problem. But we also, that number doesn't take into account all of the people. Only takes into account people who are actively in the workforce. We have huge pockets in our community that are completely and totally disconnected to the workforce, and we need to unlock those. And we have to attract talent back to this region. Thousands of jobs that are open. We will not be able to handle the economic development projects that are in the pipeline right now because we will not be able to meet the labor demand.
Yeah, going to the point you just mentioned, I've got a grandson just graduated from college in May. He just started a week ago in D.C. with a company. It's really a recruitment company that is going to train people for 10 weeks on behalf of a bunch of companies that need certain types of skills in that area. And after 10 weeks, they guarantee they're going to be placed with one of those companies. So it's a way of bringing in people for where you already have a need. How proactive are your type of efforts to have that type of approach to bring in the workforce, if you will, train them that need training, and then be able to hire those folks?
Right now in the private sector, people are just plain hiring and doing that internally and naturally. It's happening at the speed of light at this point, because the economy is so hot. So we're just figuring it out as we go.
And I would say any workforce development program, whether you're trying to get somebody who's got a, you know, high-level engineering degree or someone who's entering the workforce for the first time, you have to partner with the private sector so that there is an actual job there. So that program is something that's a model across the spectrum of opportunities there. And I know Center State had some really great programming around that. But it's that kind of connection and training and buy-in, frankly, from the private sector to make sure that they're getting the talent that they need, that it's trained in the way that they need them to be trained.
Question, is this a consortium of companies that's actually funding this?
My understanding is the companies that need the employees are the ones that fund it.
Okay.
They pay for the training activity, it's how they give their room and board and all the rest of the stuff and pay them up.
Well, that's a great idea. I mean, that's businesses being proactive in a tight labor market.
Yeah, and so we're doing some similar things in that regard. We've got a talent task force that we spun up, which is looking at a variety of different things. One of which is continuing to stand up and expand the work train program that we have, which is more focusing on entry level opportunities and some of those labor pockets that I discussed that are completely disconnected and getting them activated and into gainful employment and career paths. But the other thing we're doing right now in a pilot version is actually proactively attracting engineering talent of all types here. And we've brought in the private sectors that are all looking for these jobs collectively around the table. We have about 700 or 800 jobs that could be filled if we had the people that could come in. And so we're going to take that demand. Also, they're going to pitch in some resources that we're going to try and find ways to match. And we're going to actively go out to targeted communities where we have folks that are originally from here or large densities of people who have the talents that we're looking for, but also maybe there's similarities in community, right? We want to make sure it's somewhere that knows what snow is. We want to make sure it's somewhere that has some of the cultural similarities of what this region has. And we're going to actively go out and target some of those regions to draw talent back here. So that is right now we're anticipating that beginning to actually have programming around that in January of 19, where we're going to go out and do that. And that'll be a test run to see how does that work and can we continue to expand that into other areas.
Another
That's just
question
one,
over,
one of the seven areas.
Question over this way.
Laura, what's the effect of Trump's tariffs on your business and other businesses in Central New York?
That's a good question. We're in metalworking, so you'd think I'd have a strong answer, but I really don't feel, we don't feel anything just yet. Slight price increases on some raw materials, a little bit of tightening. It's sometimes harder to get raw material, but we're not passing any of those increases on to our customers. And so far, we're kind of all in it together from the bottom to the top of the supply chain. And it's not really registering. We're too busy just trying to fill our orders.
I think that most of us realize that the tech economy, is a success and growing. My question is about one of the negative perceptions in our community, poverty. What about programs to train low-income people who usually have, you know, two problems? They need training, and then they need transportation from where they live to where they want to work. And specifically, I was thinking about the inland port. I haven't heard anything more about that. That was supposed to solve one of these problems.
Just on the poverty question, it's something that Mayor Walsh and our team are working on, trying to dig into those numbers and find some hope within them. And I think, you know, there's data that can bear out some of the points Councillor Rudd was making, but our workforce participation amongst those communities is very, very low. And your point is exactly right. How do we get into that and start to change that cycle? There's no easy one-way answer, but it's certainly in partnership with the private sector, with our economic development partners. The county is a great partner around this. They administer all the social services programs. to find the barrier. So transportation is a huge one, partnering with Centro, the social services programs. If you are going to start entering the workforce, do you lose your benefits immediately? And then what are you going to do for daycare? I mean, these are fundamental questions people struggle with, and trying to wrap a suite of services around folks so that they can succeed is something that WorkTrain has been very successful at. I know our other workforce development partners are at the table on. It's a problem, and it's not going to change overnight, but we have to keep plugging away at it to that point.
Laura, did you have a comment?
Yep. The private sector quietly hires some of the people that you're mentioning. It happens, again, organically. We have a number of people who started out in that situation and have stayed with us and have built middle-class lives. The key is the connections, right? And we have found, and we're demonstrating to our industry partners, that building relationships, believe it or not, directly with teachers on the ground, because teachers know the children that they have in their classroom, and some of them might be really object-oriented people and tend to head towards making things, and other people might be people-oriented people and probably would be better off on the sales side or the people side of the business. So there's all kinds of connections that we can make, each and every one of us can make in the field to find an individual and work them into our economic networks. We pull people from a Jiffy Lube, for example. So a Jiffy Lube job might be somebody's first job, but that person has demonstrated sort of an object orientation and has had some great training, so we pull them in. So there's all these natural ways it's happening, but I don't think we're very good at describing that.
The approach we take at Center State on economic development is very different. It's a holistic approach, right? So we are looking at the innovation economy, we are looking at community development, we are looking at strengthening our existing businesses. It's an across-the-board approach, and we could spend an entire session, probably 10 sessions, on the issue of poverty and how do we work on that, because there are things that are there. But the overarching thing I will say is twofold. You have to be intentional about how you're going to create jobs, because you cannot just create a job and expect that that is going to help solve our poverty issue. We could create 5,000 jobs tomorrow, and if we aren't intentional about, are they accessible, what are the pathways, where are they located, right, that is going to be a problem. The other side of that equation is you can't serve people out of poverty. You can't wrap social services around someone and say, great, now you're going to be out of poverty. It's not to say that those services are not important. They absolutely are. There has to be an intentionality about where that job is created and whether it's accessible or not. And that's both physically accessible from a transportation standpoint and accessible as it relates to the skill level, the qualifications, and how they get into that job. And then you have to also have those services wrapped around that individual, because they have barriers and challenges that are intrinsic in their situation that they are going to need help to overcome in order to be successful in that. Once you get them through that, once you get them on that path, and once they start down that road, then you have solved that problem for that one person and that one family. And that is an issue that we have, that is a solution that we have to repeat time and time again. And so this is a community-wide problem. And so Laura's point is very well taken. How do we solve that problem together? Each of us needs to do something to help solve that problem. We did not get here in a year or 2 years. We got here in decades worth of not talking about it. When you used to bring up the issue of poverty to economic developers, we would say that's not our purview, right? That's not our responsibility. Talk to Health and Human Services about that, or talk to United Way, or talk to some other organization. That is a real problem that economic developers are finally coming around and saying, this is our problem too.
Well, I appreciate so much the what you've said so far in terms of addressing poverty and the disconnected populations, because I'm very much aware that just a few blocks from here in that direction, there's a community in this city that economic development has not touched in decades, probably since before I was born. So I want to encourage you all to continue to think about this issue, because there, particularly in Syracuse, there are populations that economic development has not touched. And when we're talking about bringing talent into Syracuse, there's kind of that disconnect of not recognizing that. There are talented people here in Syracuse already. they haven't been provided with the resources to demonstrate their talent. And I love what you said about connecting with teachers to help develop the talent of students. So yes, please go to school.
Great. Yes, so, go ahead.
I think we also have to be careful about the language we use. We, from the field of manufacturing, you know, we tend to use the word tech. We heard that word earlier. The word tech, and we've all heard advanced manufacturing, right? That language is actually kind of scary, and it makes one think, well, that sounds too high for me. I can't. How do I get in there? Maybe I'm not college bound, or maybe I'm not advanced, or maybe I'm not a techie, right? But in reality, on the ground, we are using technology every day, and you can start in a goods-producing job and learn as you go. And we're not very good about saying that. And we also don't use the word work very often in our economic conversations, right? How often we hear the word career, we hear pathways, we hear technology, we hear all kinds of kind of fancy language that hides the word work. So I would also encourage all of us as we prep young people, you know, to walk into a place and say, hey, I'm looking for work. And that's the start, very often, of something great.
Real quick on the point of talent attraction, we have a short-term problem and we have a long-term problem. And we have a demand for jobs right now. And when I say we're going out and doing talent attraction, the demand is for people with 5 to 10 years of experience in a particular field and with particular advanced degrees. We need to make sure that we're also providing opportunities that 10 to 15 years from now, our local people are serving those positions. But we also need to make sure that those companies that are looking for hundreds of people in that field right now don't go, I can't get that in Syracuse today, so I'm going to go do it in Austin, or I'm going to go do it in DC, or I'm going to go do it in Boston or wherever. And so the talent attraction piece for us is a short-term strategy as we continue to work on those long-term strategies. How do we make sure that we're giving opportunities so that people do have a pathway to have work and to also then if they are wanting to and have an aptitude for pursuing more advanced studies or more advanced employment, that they can do that. Right now, that's just not an option. It's a scary thing for people to think about because they, you know, they're not even sure how they have a job that you know can provide them with a sustainable living, as opposed to how do I go out and pursue a bachelor's or a master's degree. So we have to solve those long-term issues, but we also have a short-term problem in our economy that we have to solve, or else we're going to lose companies.
So I want to thank our speakers today. Give them a round of applause. Thanks for coming out.